The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You're listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Ski. This is the TWBC podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, greetings one and all, and welcome to this latest edition of the TWBC podcast. My name is Tony Lightfoot, and glad to have you, and indeed glad to have my guest here for this podcast. It's none other than Freddie Winter. We're going to try and catch up on a lot of things, but welcome first of all, Freddie. How's things going?
Yeah, doing well, Tony. Thank you for asking. Certainly better than they could be.
Okie doke. So things were going pretty good. After Marrakesh in Morocco, and then things went kind of sideways on you a little bit there. So we're going to cover that a little bit, and your rehab and what have you, and anything else that's connected in it, but. I would assume that the day that you had that crash at the Monaco slalom competition is absolutely seared in your memory.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to forget the date, June 26th, 2024, anytime soon. It's been three and a bit months, but no, it's. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I've been counting up the days since that crash. Balance in my head and understand in my head, you know, how I'm recovering and also, you know, how long it's been and how long it will be until I next ski and be competitive again.
Indeed. So I mean, pretty much anyone that's connected with the sport knows the circumstances behind the crash. You were skiing between four and five. I think, what was it, 39 and a half off or 10.75?
41.
41 off. Okay, 41 off. My bad on that one.
Yeah, dude, if I'd have done this at 39, I'd have been pretty upset. I don't think it's possible to do it at 39, to be honest with you. I mean, people have asked me how far away the dock was, and it was pretty damn far. There's not enough energy in at 39 to get that far, and I think that, you know, it took a pretty special arrangement of things to line up for me to be able to hit the dock. And you know, 41, it's a beast, and it is, you know, a reminder to me to respect it. You know, like I do. But yeah, it was a lot of energy needed to happen in order to get there.
So the dock placement wasn't the end all and be all behind what happened, or do you feel things could have been made better in that regard?
No, I mean, you know, the thing is, I can't point a finger at any specific site because there's a lot of sites that we have docks even closer, and there's a lot of sites we have docks the same distance from the lake, from the skiing area, I guess, from the course. You know, it was quite funny in the days sort of right after I hit the dock and was in hospital for a number of days, for 6 days, and then sort of, you know, certainly incapable of getting up. But about 2 weeks afterwards, I went back to Rotbruin to pick up my bag, after going back to see the surgeon, for a checkup after surgery. And I saw it again, and I was like, well, that's actually a lot further away than I thought it was, you know, in those sort of 2 weeks. So it's, yeah, water skiing is a dangerous sport, is the first thing I'll say. And I think that, you know, generally safety in water skiing is not of the highest, because it's just not, that's not pointing a finger at any particular site or tournament or organization or anything. It's just, you know, we don't have good levels of safety, particularly because these things don't tend to happen, you know, it's a reminder that we should probably up those levels. If there is a dock in the way, then probably, you know, I'm going to be talking to all the places I go and ski at next year, just to make sure that there's going to be, maybe, you know, if there's something like that, to have it padded, which would have helped me probably quite a lot. to have a bit of padding on there. But, you know, again, it's been there for, I don't know, 30 years and no one's hit it. No one's come close to hitting it. And I've never been in a position where I probably had that much speed that far from the course. But again, it was a... I'll tell you what happened, if you like.
I came
out of boy four. This is as I remember it. And as it's been described to me, I haven't watched the video because I don't care to look at that. I think
neither do I, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I don't want to have that in my mind. But I came out of boy four, big turn. I have a big onside turn, and I was trying to get around five and over to six. And I was late, wasn't in the best shape, but big hit, lost my hips behind me, back foot came out. I managed to keep my balance just long enough to get across the second wake to the point at which I was, you know, struggling for my life in at that time, if you know, to hold on and not fall. I got, because I did, let's say, a good enough job or you know, too good of a job of not falling, I got past the second wake. And that's where if you hit the second wake, you slow down. Well, then I got to the flat water on the other side and I flipped over the front softly onto my back. Instead of a big splash, I kind of flipped over just enough to where I was skidding along basically on my back, not slowing down. When you see a splash, that's energy being dissipated. Yeah. When it's just skimming, you don't lose any speed.
Yeah.
Lose any energy. So you know, a lot of people said to me that I accelerated towards the dock. I mean, that's definitely not true, but I definitely didn't slow down. So that's where I hit it. I felt a hit on my body, which was a surprise, but it didn't hurt that much. And there I am in the water, in a, you know, slowly realizing that my season was over, as I saw my leg looking extremely squashed and wonky.
Because you weren't in pain immediately after you hit. I mean,
no.
from what it sounds like.
No, not at all. And that was kind of one of the most interesting things for me was I didn't feel pain, and that's why I thought I was okay. I mean, from what I've been told, I don't remember this, but in between passing out a couple of times, I apparently tried to stand up on this, you know, leg that was only attached by skin, hey, muscle and blood vessels. So it wasn't great. But I mean, the immediate aftermath was fairly harrowing but also very fortuitous in a lot of ways, because I had, you know, Greg Desfond, who's you know, a phenomenal guy who helped Whitney.
He always seems to have a knack for being there.
He's the man. He's water skiing's patron saint, as far as I'm concerned. And you know, he jumped in the water. He also, at the same site, had helped me out the previous year when I'd winded myself. And he got in the water. He grabs me from behind. I'm sitting on the... He's sitting on the floor. We're in about a foot of water. He's sitting on the ground underneath the water, and he grabs me and he goes, "You're okay, you're okay, you're okay." And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, I know I'm okay. I feel fine, you know. I ran four boys, whatever." And
then you look down,
and I had my nan there who ran down as well in the water as well, and she's sort of holding my legs. And then I'm saying, "Am I okay? Am I okay?" You know, just making sure. She's, you know, someone I have a very long history with, and you know, a very good person to be there in that instance. And we both looked down at the exact same moment and realized that my leg was in very, very bad shape, flat and sitting off towards the left. And I was like, "Oh man, oh my God." First thought was, even before I've broken my leg, it's my season's over. And it was pretty rough, because I remember being in that moment sort of very, very angry that all the sacrifice I'd made, the hard work, the, you know, the all of everything I'd done for the whole year leading up to that point was wasted, because I was going to have to spend a significant amount of time off in the sidelines. And
the fact that this was less than 6 months after claiming your second world title, pretty much. Six months anyway.
So, yeah, and it wasn't a season without success, so I can look back at it with happiness. I won Moomba, and that was the last of the sort of, you know, the old school sort of big three to win. So that was really good. That was a dream for me to achieve. But then, yeah, like I'd got on the podium a couple of times since. I got 2 seconds, including Rockbrun. But yeah, no, it was a disappointing to not, because I was 100% certain I was going to start winning again, you know, or at least you'd be very, very competitive. So now that was a real bummer. But I mean, to answer your question, no, the pain didn't come then. The pain came afterwards. At 20 minutes in the water, they're trying to take my boot off my foot. I did not want it taken off my foot, because I could feel the bloody bone grinding, you know, inside, because it was overlapped, right? The bone was it wasn't a part, that the muscle was contracting and pulling the lower part towards my hip, so it was overlapping. Very, very painful. when they moved me, which was after about 25 minutes.
And almost then, sounds like a spiral fracture, right?
No, it wasn't a spiral fracture. It wasn't a clean break as some people were saying, but it was broken in one point and had gone side, sort of in split sideways. And so I had, it was in three pieces, two big pieces, and then a very small, what they call papillon, or in France is what they called it, or a butterfly, So anyway, there I am off to hospital, CT scans, x-rays, all this, you know, again, every time they moved me, very, very tons of pain. And then I was waiting for surgery. That was the worst part of the whole thing. Cause it felt like I was on a bed that was at an angle that I was sliding down towards my knee. You know, my pelvis was sliding down towards my knee, but it wasn't that. It was that the muscle again had gone into, I don't know why it does it, but it did it. My muscles were in complete spasm, and you know, at that time I had very strong legs, as strong as I can get them, right? So you know, those muscles were contracting as much as possible. And what I hadn't appreciated at the time was that every time the muscle contracts, you know, on a normal body, the bone stops it from over contracting. Well, I didn't have any bones, you know, so all it was doing was pulling the two pieces together. And that was where I was in agony. And the last 2 or 3 hours before I had surgery, which was about at midnight, 1 or 2 in the morning, were horrible. And then I had surgery. What most people, a lot of people who listen to this will know that I had broken my femur hitting the dock. But what people might not know is I had my femur broken a second time during surgery. So the surgeon put the rod, which is a 40 centimeter or you know, foot and a half long rod, down the length of my femur, but he put it off slightly off center. This is what we found out subsequently. Slightly off center. So he's hammering it in, and the femur at the top, it's split sort of in half. So if you can imagine, it's like if the breaks would look like a T, if that makes sense, like a, you know, yeah, along the middle of the bone. I was very fortunate. Again, I mean, that's the thing that's worth remembering. So I didn't hit my head, which I would have died. You know, you can't sustain that much of an injury, hit to your head and not go, you know, at least brain dead. Didn't hit my back or neck, which would have broken my neck, ribs, you know, internal organs. I mean, I hit it with serious, I mean, what I've been told is that this was basically a motorbike accident with the intensity, because you know, to break a femur of someone that's healthy and relatively young is extremely difficult to do. I mean, yeah, the amount of force involved is massive. So I was very lucky there that it was only my femur, and also that, frankly, that it was at the top of my femur and not the bottom. If it was in the bottom, they'd have put the rod in from the bottom and had to go through my patellar tendon, which would have been, again, the end of my sporting career. So I mean, you know, fortunate that it was at the top and it goes in from the top. But yeah, so we didn't know any of these problems with the surgery because I don't know if there was they didn't pick it up on the x-rays, whatever, but it was finally I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't no one could explain why I was in so much pain when I moved. Like every time I got out of bed, my every time I articulated my leg slightly, there was like a big clunk and a huge pain. So I'm telling the doctors in France, you know, this is not working, there's something wrong. No, it's fine, we're looking at the x-rays. Finally had a CT scan. So about, it was when you were in San Gervasio, on the Saturday, and I got a call from I had the CT scan on the Friday, and I got a call from a very Phil Mitchell is a very high level doctor who was putting me in touch with the one of the world's and Britain's best orthopedic surgeons. They looked at this this CT scan and they saw this vertical fracture, and that was a dark day because that was about 2.5 weeks after, it was one and a half weeks after the initial accident. So that was like, oh my god, so I've not just got to deal with this broken leg, it's a twice broken leg, and you know, also the fracture that's split sideways hasn't been fixed, right? Because the rod's in there to hold the top and bottom pieces together, but there's nothing in there apart from a very slight nail holding the two pieces of bone together at the top. So yeah, dark day. And you know, there's a number of other weird things. We subsequently found out that my leg was attached 15 degrees with my foot 15 degrees to the left, my right foot, so I'm more pigeon-toed even than I already was. So yeah, a number of strange things. There was a couple extra drill holes put through the bottom near my knee as a result of missing that you have the screws that hold the rod in place and hold your bone so it doesn't rotate. There was a couple of missed the screw holes that missed the rod, so that caused an excess healing process down at the bottom. So there's an ossification of bone, so I've got this extra bit of like sort of lump of bone 3 or 4 centimeters across that's just in my muscle next to my knee, that for a long time was stopping me from articulating my leg. I couldn't straighten it. So that was a bit worrying, but hopefully that's all good. So yeah, it wasn't just the initial break from the dock. I mean, I've sustained further damage from the surgical process. And of course, look, the guy did his absolute best. I don't hold anyone to account. You know, it's a very tough situation. Apparently my bones were very, very tough. He said that, he told me that to hammer the nail through the rod through was extremely hard, because he's used to dealing with older people with softer bones. I've got very tough bones, which is a good thing. That'll hopefully hold me in good stead going forward. But a few disappointing days. Obviously the initial 26th of June, and then sort of mid July, finding out the rotation, whatever. The doctor at the time, the surgeon in the UK, told me that normally he would consider pulling the rod out, rotating my foot back straight, so it was at 0 degrees instead of sort of minus 15, if you like, or at sort of 10-2, 10 to the hour on a clock,
which would be perfect for tricking.
It may be, but so he would think about doing that, but he couldn't do that because of the break at the top. And the rod already being slightly offset, he wouldn't be able to put it back in, and it would be too fragile for it to hold. And we couldn't risk that. So that's kind of why I'm going to have a bit of a weird walk from now on. And there is that could be fixed later if it becomes an issue. I'm hoping it doesn't. But yeah, so all in all, less than ideal, Tony.
So just to clarify, it's going to be your front leg that's going to be shorter, isn't it?
Yeah, that is only half a centimeter, which is within the normal realms of people. I don't know how much longer it or shorter it was. It could have been longer last time, and I don't know. I mean, and these things, Freddy Krueger told me something that was very smart a few years ago. I'd run a really good score in practice for a tournament, and then I'd hit something in the water and bash the tail of my ski. And Freddy Krueger said he saw me stressing about it. And he goes, Freddy, you know what? There's a chance that it got worse, but there's a good chance it also got better. This might be the fine tuning it needed. So it could be that my slightly skew-if front foot, with maybe a slightly shorter, than it was, maybe that I'm going to be more balanced next season. It's going to make me even better. So
glass half full or half empty?
Well, I don't know. There's not. I mean, it will be different.
Yes,
but it could be a benefit. You know what? We all change our fins and our skis and all that sort of stuff. There's nothing to say. I wasn't the best water skier in the world. I've never been the best water skier in the world for a sustained period. So I can't say that I was ever perfect. So there is a good chance that it's half a chance at least that this could actually help me to improve. And who's to say that it can't?
All right then. So You've got through that in a rather extended period of time. Let's talk a little bit about safety priorities a little bit, because obviously your crash has obviously highlighted the safety provisions for a lot of competitions, including pro events like this one at Monaco, and in recent years priorities. The medical safety priorities has been leaning towards concussions. People have received training on it. Judges, they're all supposed to be versed on the concussion, but not so when it comes to like a crash which you've sustained. Do you believe that there should be better provision for in terms of handling what you've sustained, not only for legs but also arms and as you probably pointed out, you were quite close to. I mean, if you'd have turned around the wrong way and you hit your head, it's game over.
Yeah, and then there would have been nothing left to do but to pull me out of the water. So that wouldn't have been much saving me at that point. So I think safety is an issue, and it's something that I haven't really paid too much attention to, but I think that we're doing an extreme sport. We can't claim that it's ever going to be 100% safe. People are going to hurt themselves. People are going to hurt themselves without being anywhere near a dock. There's going to be twists of ankles. There's going to be this, that, and the other. Jumping, you know, people jumping 70 plus meters. I mean, these are dangerous things. But what we can do is probably have a bit more of an eye on, you know, in case the bad happens, what can we do? Like, and that comes down to having a stretcher on site, mm-hmm. having a plan if someone is to get hurt. Where's the ambulance going to come to? Where, you know, all these sorts of things. Like, how, you know, do we have a competent doctor who's going to not panic? So we don't have a sport which has enough money in it currently to have the best safety measures. And frankly, you know, I know that, you know, if we have the Travers Grand Prix this weekend, right, there's $15,000 total prize money for the men. If you asked all of the men, the 24 men that are skiing tomorrow, you know, hey, we're going to take $3,000 away from the prize purse and put it into an ambulance being on site this weekend, they'd all say no. So there's a decision to be made there. Maybe, you know, the budgets are not huge, but they tend to be put towards webcast and prize purse. And I've definitely been at the forefront of saying, yeah, no, let's raise the prize purses. So
yeah,
it's very difficult. We're not in a resource rich sport in that way, in terms of, you know, we can't afford to pay people, particularly, and we can't afford to, you know, there's just not the sort of the resources of people either. So yeah, good question. But I think that people, I'm going to be talking to the tournament organizers next year and just say, hey, listen, you know, I don't want to be a pain, but, you know, do you have a stretcher that can be used in the water? Do you have a plan going forward if something bad is to happen?
In some places, like Italy, that's not even a question, because, I mean, you can't even run a tournament without an ambulance on standby.
No, for sure. But then there's other places, you know, in the UK, yeah, that's not the case. And I think, you know, the thing is, you mentioned, the other thing is the best laid plans and all that. You mentioned concussions. The International Federation were putting together all these seminars, as you mentioned, and talking about concussions for you know, the best part of a year, and then the World Championships at the end of that year, well, shortly afterwards, Whitney McClintock sustained a concussion and then skied in the final. I don't blame her for that. I would have done the same. I would have tried to ski too. But, you know, like, you can put all the plans together, but then you have to implement them.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, that's also not the easiest thing to do in the moment, if you're not prepared to really, you know, consider what you're doing.
All right, then. So let's see if we can distance ourselves a little bit from what you sustained after the crash and what have you. We'll try and circle back and see what the prognosis is for whatever comes up next. You know, because, I mean, it's going to take about a year, isn't it? I mean, as essentially, or a little under a year before you can actually get back on a slalom ski. Isn't that right?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, I was told by the doctor, this top level orthopedic surgeon, that it was going to be 6 months to a year. That was what he said about you know, a month, when I saw him a month after. As soon as I got back to England, I saw him the very next day, and he, you know, he's the top man, and that was pretty depressing to hear him. You know, 12 months is far too long, and I'm not, you know, I wasn't going to have that if I had any power over it. And then since he's, you know, I've been seeing Tom Williams, who you know very well.
Oh yeah,
fantastic, absolutely. Physio and skier. Who's been happy with my, and, you know, Tom is a, you know him very well. He's not a guy that's going to tell me something I want to hear. He's going to be realistic, and not over optimistic just to make me happy. And he's told me he's very happy with how I'm doing. And he said that he said that in my opinion, as long as things would work out, that we need to get a sign off from the surgeon, that he thinks I could ski in January. I went to see the surgeon a couple of days later. This was about 2 weeks ago. And he said that bone looks like it's healing fine. You know, I'm doing the things that I need to do. In terms of, you know, clean living, not, you know, not smoking every day and drinking, you know, a bottle of whiskey. So he said that January's fine. So, you know, there's a few things that have to happen between now and then, i.e. the bone needs to continue to mend. And I think that's, I had a lot of people tell me, oh, well, you know, bones heal in 10 weeks. Well, it's completely, this is absolutely not true, as I've understood. Apparently with catastrophic injuries, bones take, you know, 6 months to heal, and they mature for another year after that.
And it depends upon the bones as well, because as you previously mentioned, your bones are a lot stronger than most people's.
Well, maybe they're stronger. I don't know if they're stronger than most people's, but they're maybe stronger than someone who's 70. But I think, you know, it's the biggest bone in your body, the femur.
Yeah.
And doing a, you know, a lot of damage to not just the bone but all the muscles and everything around that's actually that's tough, and it takes the healing process longer to start. And once it starts, you know, you hope it continues for a long time. And I did manage to break a significant bone. It's not the case, like, it's not like when you break a bone in your finger that can be back in 12 weeks. There's no pressure goes through your finger for most things, right? But there's a lot of pressure goes through your femurs, and I've got a long way to go, but I plan to be skiing in January, and I plan to go to Moomba.
Excellent stuff. We certainly look forward to that. But you've had to try and occupy your time someone in the absence of being out there on the water. Let's take a look at some of the events that you've missed without to shed too much of a tear.
Well, I missed the Botas tournament. I missed San Gervasio. I missed Oxford, where I ski myself all the time. Which is tragic. I mean, Steve Glanfield's such a great guy. I wanted to ski at his tournament. I know that a little bit of him, he wanted me to ski in that tournament as well and do well at his tournament. So that was really sad. But I watched them all. I watched you all weekend, Tony, for all of those. Missed California. Uh-huh. I missed Mastercraft Pro, which was tough, but it was nice sitting in the booth with you.
Absolutely.
Then I'm going to miss Travers, King of Darkness, and Miami. So this will be the extent that I miss as far as I'm concerned and what, you know, as much as I have control over it.
All right, then. So aside from joining me in the announcing booth for those ladder tournaments, I mean, what have you been doing, you know, to occupy your time except being laid up in bed with your leg?
Well, that was where I kind of realized I was going to have to, you know, tough it out a little bit, because I mean, basically, I, you know, there's three things that I really, really enjoy in life, which I would, you know, depending on what part of the year long cycle it is, I push myself towards. And, you know, one of them is water skiing, which is a huge part of it. Couldn't do that, broken leg. One of them was, playing sports outside of that. So, I, you know, if it's pickleball or squash, racket, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I enjoy competitive sports, and that's what I do when I'm trying to be healthy away from skiing. And then, and, you know, the third is kind of, you know, having a beer with my friends. I couldn't do that because I got to be professional and let the bone heal. So basically, I mean, I've lay in bed. I've read a lot of books. I'm currently helping my savior Greg Desfond out with the Water Ski Journal. I'm finishing up a bunch of articles that I've written for that, which it should be out, you know, released, I guess, you know, at some point before too long, when we get everything together. It's very nice, like you say, to join you in the booth, Tony. I mean, it's one of, you know, someone said to me, well, isn't it tough to watch all those guys go out there and ski? And I'm like, yeah, bloody right it is. But it's also nice to be involved, and I'm going to be watching it anyway from home, so I might as well sort of, you know, have a chit chat on the mic and hopefully put a little bit of insight, you know, that I've managed to get from skiing against all these guys for all these years. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of been it. Also, you know, 10,000 miles of Instagram that I've scrolled through from bed. But yeah, it's not been as bad as I was, you know, worried about. I've managed to kind of, you know, keep my head up and you know, rehab and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And the good thing is I've felt like I've improved every day, even just a little bit, you know, less pain, more mobility, able to, you know, get around a bit more by myself. And no, it's not, it's been tough, and I had a, you know, frankly a shit summer, but it's not been as bad as I thought of previously. If you'd have told me it was going to happen, I'd have imagined it would have been a lot worse than it actually ended up being, let's say that.
Now, if any of you have ever watched the movie that starred Daniel Bruhl and Chris Hemsworth, that Formula One movie about
Russia,
Russia with Niki Lauda and
James Hunt,
you know, the scenes where Niki Lauda was like lying up in bed, you know, seeing James Hunt rack up all of the points in his absence. Do you kind of have an appreciation for what that's like, you know, trying to push yourself and be determined even more to get back into the scene?
Without a doubt. I don't think it makes that much of a difference, because I couldn't be more motivated anyway. I mean, my you know, the day after surgery, I'm in bed, you know, counting in my head how many days I've got and when I need to start training for Moomba, and, you know, all thinking of all the stuff I'm going to do. I'm definitely, you know, I had a big injury in 2016 when I broke my ankle and you know, pulled off the deltoid ligament, had it reattached surgically, and I won my first world championships 13 months later. So I'm very motivated. I've got a bunch of notes in my phone of all the things that I'm going to change about my skiing that I think have been lacking technically over the years. Right when I come back, just watching, you know, watching people ski, I keep an eye on things that I'm sort of like, I'm let's say jealous of how they do things better than me, and I, you know, something to inspire me to get better. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no anyone that tells you they're happy to watch from the sidelines while everyone else is successful, they're liars. And I'm absolutely fine saying that I haven't liked, you know, sitting and watching. I'd much rather be there and with a chance of winning. But it's fuel for the fire, and you know, it's like I said before, like with now. Instead of, you know, I'm going to be a little bit different. My body's going to be a slightly modified, let's say, and I've just got the way I'm thinking about it is that, like, I've had some success in the sport. I've won a handful of tournaments, whatever it is, and I've always followed somewhat the same path, slightly modified once in a while, but I kind of, you know, it's eat well, be fit, technique, da-da-da, you know, all this sort of stuff, and so that's been my path to the top. Well, now I'm coming around from a much lower point from the other side of the mountain, and it's actually going to be a novel and more interesting path on the way back up. I've never done this before. I've had a bad injury before. I've never had come back from an injury as bad as this. And frankly, I think that, you know, in the slalom field today, no one's broken their femur. I know Wade Cox did it a number of years ago and Marcus Brown did it, but, like, you know, that's a big, big injury. So I'm really motivated to come back and win, and be successful. Having had an injury that you know could have ended my career, and I think, you know, could have been an extremely
could have been fatal if it had you moved any other position.
Could have been fatal, absolutely. And also, some people might have said, "Well, you know what, I'm done. You know, I'm 34 years old. It could be that I could have called it quits on my career." That's not happening. The day afterwards, I was like, "I'm gonna be the guy that comes back and wins with having to, you know, lost a battle with a slalom with a dock." You know. So that's my plan. That's what I'm hoping to do, and you know, as long as my body cooperates, and as Tom Williams said, it's only one part of my body. You know, I need it to be strong, but like if everything else is good, then it's going to be I'm going to be fine.
All right then. So I mean, you've had a lot of support from a lot of different people. I mean, I think you mentioned Manon a little bit earlier on.
Where I stayed at her mum's place for a month when I wasn't able to. I couldn't get out of bed. You know, her mum made me three meals a day. You know,
a greater appreciation for French home style cooking.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, it was phenomenal. And I've been really well supported. And I think, you know, I can genuinely say, like a lot of people got in touch with me through whatever messaging means, WhatsApp, Instagram. I got, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages. I didn't get back to all of them, but, you know, it really did make me feel very grateful for the amount of support. It made me feel like I, you know, appreciated and supported and motivated, that I got, you know, let's say people behind me. And that, you know, that is a really good feeling. Even some of my fellow pro skiers, you know, I had a conversation with Will Ashley the other day. I mean, he messaged me a couple of days afterwards. He said, "Look, I just wanted to let the dust settle, but, you know, this is terrible for you, but, you know, you've got that," he said something like, "you've got that winner's mentality, and we'll see you, you know, above us on the podium again." And that, you know, that really, really meant a lot. Even, you know.
Yeah, that's always nice.
Well, it's not something you necessarily expect. And, you know, Will and I have never been, you know, ultra close, and we, you know, we've certainly had our disagreements, many of them my fault. So, you know, to get that from someone who I, you know, hugely respect as one of the greatest competitors that the sport has ever seen, that really meant a lot. And for him to sort of put me on his level, let's say, of having a winner's mentality and a fighting spirit, that was motivating. And, you know, like, Matty Gonzalez, it was probably a month ago, I just randomly get a message out of nowhere from Matty Gonzalez, who's you know, one of my favorite trickers, just saying, "Hey Freddie, I'm just thinking about you and how you're going to do really well next year." And I mean, that's to get that from a guy that he has no reason to send that to me, it's just super nice. I'm hugely grateful for all the support, and it makes me very, very happy, very, very motivated.
Indeed, indeed. So, I mean, you've got it. You've got quite a path ahead of you, between now and January. I don't know much more I can actually ask of you, but obviously, in the middle of the summer, I mean, you're in France, and the Olympics were going on around about that time. So, was that whole festival and carnival atmosphere going on? You know,
it started just after I got back, actually.
Started just before you got back.
Just after I got back. So I got back to the UK, and I think it started maybe just those next few days. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, branching off onto another tangent on another subject. You know, I mean, it's been years since the sport had a real fighting chance of making it into something like the Olympic program. And I know you're a consummate pro, and probably you'd rather see the pro side of the sport develop first before it gets anywhere close to being even thought of as an Olympic sport. Would you agree with that assessment?
My personal opinion, which might not be shared, is that I would rather see the sport grow professionally and never be part of the Olympics. I think the Olympics is not, from a competitive standpoint, it's not the be-all and end-all, and frankly, I think it does a lot of harm. If you look at the way that the triathletes were treated this year, with, you know, potentially having the swimming cancelled because they couldn't get the Seine depolluted enough, with the way that the boxing situation happened, where there was a failed eligibility test sort of based on gender, and you know, there's all sorts of issues associated with the Olympics, a winner every 4 years. Do we really want to be part of a 4 year cycle where, you know, if you get an injury at the wrong time, you might as well quit the sport? I don't think that being in the Olympics is great for many, many sports. And remember, you know, because it becomes the pinnacle, and the IOC, the Olympics, does not want for any sport to transcend the Olympics. They're happy to bring in popular sports to bring popularity to the Olympics, but unpopular sports that have the Olympics as their pinnacle, they don't want for those to get any bigger than the Olympics. It's not in their interest.
Yeah, because I noticed, like, athletics, you know, track and field, you know, they have their world championships every 4 years, but most athletes within the sports that are actually held under that banner regard the Olympics as being the end all and be all, you know, and being a world champion, it's great, it's fine, you know, but they even realize that the Olympics is the thing that they cherish the most rather than being a world championship.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and good for them. I think it's very unhealthy for, I'm actually writing an article about this exact topic for the Wolski Journal right now. But, you know, I think that it's very unhealthy for... Remember that of all the athletes that enter the Olympics, they all dream of winning. And even the ones that don't believe they can win, they want to get, you know, do well or get on the podium or whatever. The majority, the vast majority, come away very disappointed. Okay, you can only have one winner. You can only have three podium placements. You know, you can only have so many finalists. A lot of them come away very, very demotivated. And when it's the be-all and end-all, that's the end of a four-year cycle. You're going to train for nearly 4 years for that. That's not healthy. That's very, very unhealthy. So, you know...
Especially if their nations place a high premium on the Olympic medals, right?
Exactly. And these are people that potentially they have all sorts of stuff, you know, all sorts of funding put into their training, whatever, and then suddenly they get dropped like, you know, like a bag of crisps. Right after the Olympics is very demotivating. I don't, you know, 4 year cycle is not good for an athlete. You want to have I'm happy with a 2 year cycle that we have for the World Championships right now, or even a yearly cycle like we have for the Pro Tour. Look at the best sports in the world, the ones that are the healthiest, and I'm thinking football, you know, tennis,
rugby
less so, but you know, NFL. Like, let's all of these have a yearly cycle, right? And actually, a lot of them, Formula One, these are ones that have yearly championships. They don't need the Olympics. That's nothing to them. So I think that, you know, we need to be very careful to just jump in and say, oh, the Olympics will save everything. Yeah, there'll be a spotlight, and it would be good, but remember that spotlight is 2 years of every four. Yeah. Sorry, 2 weeks of every 4 years.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. Look, I 100% believe that the International Federation would really, really welcome being part of the Olympics, because then they'll have a lot more money. They can pay themselves more. They can, you know, all the benefits that come with money. That includes, you know, being more important, having more travel expenses, all this sort of stuff, you know, as well as all the stuff that it can do for the sport. I think that I wouldn't necessarily wish for the Olympics to for water skiing to suddenly be part of the Olympics, because I think from a competitive standpoint, it's no good. I think that the IOC, you know, they're not unimpeachable based on, you know, recent situations. I think we need to be careful of wishing for that, but you know, frankly, we're not going to get in because no one's you know, pushing for it at the international federation level that hard. I mean, can a federation with a $2,000 marketing budget really do that much, as opposed to a travel budget which is, you know, some 90 times that?
Yeah.
Can they do? Can they really push for an Olympic placement for the sport? I'm not sure.
All right, then. Before we round off this podcast, which is certainly about as long as I've ever done with you so far, as
into... sorry for taking your time, Tony.
Oh, it's fine. Come on, I'm just saying this for the people that are listening in their cars and what have you. You know, because we do have a history.
They've already turned off, mate.
No. I certainly hope not, because you and me do have a history. But you've also been watching the Pro Tour events as they've transpired. Obviously, you couldn't compete beyond Monaco, but I mean, we've had a whole slew of competitors that have won for the first time, or at least the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, with the likes of Rob Hazelwood and what have you, and Jonathan Travers over at
and Dane this last weekend
over at there. So I mean, obviously, the parity between the competitors seems to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller as the margins get more and more finite. You know, so I mean, what's your take on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting year, isn't it? I mean, you know, you've got the standard has been incredibly high for a number of years. You've got some really, really good skiers. I think that, you know, some skiers, I'm looking at Dane Meckler, who probably, you know, couldn't, let's say, not should, but, you know, was very close to wins a number of times, you know, didn't quite get there. You know,
and of course his season was shortened because he took that injury at the MLCQ, right?
Yeah, he hurt his ankle there and you know, had to take a number of months off. I think that you've got, you know, what's so funny is, like, I Will Asher started the season absolutely on fire. He won three of his first four tournaments, come second at the fourth one, you know, and just looked like he was going to win everything from then on. And, you know, then, you know, Rob stepped up, John stepped up, and, you know, Nate, who's not been a guy that's won the majority of tournaments in the last number of years, has not been as competitive as he previously has been. So yeah, I mean, I've not been there and been able to, you know, try and get the wins that I've had in the last few years, you know, a handful of times. So I think that, you know, there's that level of competition it's even more even, if that makes sense. Where, you know, whereas before Will and Nate were taking a huge number of the wins, and, you know, now there's it's a bit more open.
Who do you think's waiting to gain his? Who do you think is next to get their first win, male or female?
Good question. I think, well, if you'd have asked me a week ago, I'd have said Dane 100%. He was, yeah. You know, he's been the guy. I thought that he was going to be the guy that would win first before anyone else this year.
Of course, let's not forget Colm McCormick. I mean, he got Masters.
Yeah, no, for sure. And Dane's been there or thereabouts for a long time, and longer than basically the other guys that have won. So who's the next guy? Charlie Ross.
Ross. Yeah, I mean, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I think the next superstars that we have are the really young guys. You know, if you look at the field, that Charlie Ross is, you know, he's very, very good, and he's only going to get better. Lucas will be the same. He's come onto the scene big time this year, so I think we're going to see those guys start taking wins, and they'll be deserved, because I mean, you know, you have, like, not to be I think that those guys are top quality in waiting, if that makes sense. You know, there's that you can, you know, these are sort of, let's say, generational talents, I think, that you know, I think that we haven't seen, you know, really maybe since Nate came along.
What about among the female competitors? I mean, because that's more difficult, because I mean, like, last season you had like Ali Nicholson come through with a win or two last season, but I mean, it's, you know, it's either Ali or Jamie or Regina that have come through with wins in the women's slalom event, and we're waiting to see who's coming next.
I don't think anyone's going to get a win and a first win anytime soon in the women's field, because you've got Regina, who we all know about her. You've got, you know, when she doesn't win, there's Jamie and Whitney, who are top quality, you know, and certainly as good as Regina on their day, or, you know, or better. I mean, they've taken about even number of wins between the three of them in the last few years, I would say. Certainly since 2021. And then, you know, if they're not there, then it's Manon and Ali. Yeah. Ali, you know, Manon won in Oxford. She's come back strong this year. She ran 10.75. Ali Nicholson has won four events in the last few years. She won at Morocco this year.
Yeah. Got a nice little watch as well.
Yeah, she did. She certainly did. You know, who's the next one? Elizabeth Montevon came fourth or whatever it was this last weekend. Ahead of Whitney, ahead of Ali. She's won already.
Yeah.
You know, she won at Miami a number of years ago. But I just don't think you're going to see Regina, Whitney, Jamie, all three screw up. And then even if they do, I don't think you're going to see Manon screw up, Ali screw up. I don't think you're going to see that for a number of years. I think that it's going to stay in that little core group of really three, four or five.
Does that kind of concern you a little bit?
Not in the slightest. If you look at men's versus women's tennis for that sort of golden period from about, you know, 2007 or 8 through to 2000 and let's say 2020, the men's side was only, I think there was, you know, Del Potro won one and Marat Safin, whatever the guy was, there was outside of the big four, Murray won two, Djokovic won however many, Nadal and Federer won a bunch. There was no one won. In that time, there were sort of like 25 women's tennis open Grand Slam winners. And it was the most boring thing possible because there was no one any good for any sustained period. What's interesting in sport is high quality rivalries. If you have one person winning everything, that's really boring. But if you have high quality rivalries, that's the best thing possible. So actually, women's skiing is, you know, like it was in the men's skiing for a lot. I mean, it still is. I mean, the quality is so high that you know, yes, as much as there's been a lot of winners this year, it's always kind of the same people that have been, you know, near the podium. For a number of years. I think women's skiing is arguably, you know, better than the men's or in a lot of ways. I mean, just because the pneumatic train like quality every single weekend of these three or four girls that are just amazing.
All right then. So as we begin to round off this podcast, I mean, Water Ski Pro Tour Will Asher out in the lead in men's slalom. Jamie Bow out in the lead in women's slalom. I mean, it's as we get towards the end of the season, the gaps between someone like Will and the remainder of the field will get a little bit closer, depending upon how they perform. You know, but it's great to see that kind of level of competition, and now the Water Ski Pro Tour in its third, or what is it, fourth year of existence is now starting to become well it's been a priority for a few of our skiers, you know, for quite a long time now, but now it's become a focus for a lot of those competitors, and they're really trying to push to become the end of season champion, so to speak.
Absolutely, and even if they're not trying to be the champion, they want to be as high as possible. I mean, you know, I finished my ski season in late June, and I don't like seeing my name in eighth place. We're not doing this to be not at the top, you know. And so everyone that says they don't care where they are on the Water Ski Pro Tour list, I'm not sure there's many people that are saying that, but I mean, anyone that would say that is lying. They want to be seen as the best. You know, Will is out way out in front. If you look at Will's season, I mean, it's been phenomenal. He's won three tournaments. I think he's come second at all but two of the remaining ones. He got an eighth or seventh or something at Oxford and a tenth this last weekend. But you know, he's been so good. If he's not winning, he's always been right there.
Just like Max Verstappen, you know, he hasn't won every single Grand Prix this season, but yeah, he's been second or third in the Grand Prix that he hasn't won.
Exactly.
Which is why he's still out there in the lead with about half a dozen races left to go.
For sure. And I mean, there's actually a lot of parallels there. I mean, Will won a lot right at the start of the season, same as Verstappen, and then, you know, number of tournaments have gone by, haven't quite got those wins, but I mean, always competitive, and you'd never count him out. And I, you know, frankly, I believe Will's going to win. What have we got? Three tournaments left. He'll win again this year, in my opinion. I think. And what's really exciting is, yes, Will's got all those points. He did really well. You know, very, very competitive everywhere. But then there's, you know, behind him, there's, you know, Nate in second, and then I think, you know, off the top of my head, it's then Rob, then it's Cole, then it's Corey, and tied with Corey is Thomas De Gasperi, and all these guys within about sort of 50 points. So, you know, again, they're all going to be competing until the end of the year, and they're going to want to be pushing their name up as high as possible. And I'm, you know, that's something I'm really excited for. And it's gone from being a, you know, who's the best on the day. Of course, that's primarily what it is, but people are also, they've got an eye on, where am I going to be at the end of the season? Freddy Krueger said it quite well the other day. He goes, look, I don't think about the tour, I don't think about the points, I just think about, if I go and win every tournament, then the points take care of themselves. Now, everyone's going to try and place as high as possible. As soon as they get that placement, they're going to be going, okay, well, where does that put me on the list?
That's interesting to hear from him, because I mean, going into the last jump tournament of the season, which is the King of Darkness in 3 weeks' time, there's only half a dozen points separating him and Joel Poland.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's winner takes all, isn't it? Whoever finishes ahead will win the tour, which is just, you know, very, very exciting. And what a finale from two jumpers that have, you know, done so well this year. And Freddie to be 49 years old and to still be, you know, the reigning best jumper in the world with respect of everyone, that is 100% the case, you know, and for his record, is incredible. And then for Joel's a more typical athlete, ages sort of 25, whatever it is, but he's taken wins from Freddie this year. They tied in feet in Canada, tied in meters in Canada, and they had a jump off, and you know, Freddie told me that he got beaten and he wasn't very happy about it. So, you know, Freddie's going to be wanting to come back and beat Joel, and it's great. I'm like you, Tony. I'm a water skier, but I'm also a water ski fan, big time. And so, you know, that's part of what I'm enjoying while I'm on the sidelines, is all these narratives, and this is great sport.
And it could come down to the two additional points that you get for having the best distance.
Yeah, for the best score. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and actually, if you look back, I mean, that could be, you know, Joel's ahead. I don't know how many best score points he has, but it could be that if Freddie had got those best score points in the preliminary rounds from the tournaments that he didn't win, he'd be tied or even ahead.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why that point's in there, which is very cool. You know, 2 points for their score. It's exciting too.
And for the sake of fairness, let's mention the women's jump, of course. We know, because we got Hannah Strzaltsova, who goes into the last tournament with miles and miles in the lead.
Yeah, I think she's kind of sewn it up. I think she's had it sewn up for a while. But I mean, yeah, I nerded out the other day and did a calculation, if Regina is to win everything from here on out, she will beat Jamie, who has a lot of points. So, you know, that's pretty special. There's all sorts of narratives you can go look at. And that's, you know, worth going to look at the stats on waterskiprotour.com, so you can kind of see how it's all tabulated and how the points are made and you know, and the points available for this weekend. If people come in certain places, what points they'll end up with. And no, it's very, very cool. You know, I think it's, I can only speak for myself, but I find it so exciting, because when I'm watching the Formula One, of which I'm quite a big fan, like when
me too,
when everyone crosses the line, it's like, okay, cool. So, you know, Verstappen came third and Norris came second. Where are they on the leaderboard? What's the difference? You know, how are we, you know, what does this mean to the total championship? And at this point, with the closing stages of both the Formula One calendar and the Waterski Pro Tour calendar, well, that this is the most exciting time for these points. You know, it's really down to the big moments.
You know, and it could come, and you know, it could come down to Daniel Ricciardo's last act of significance in Formula One, being able to take to deny like Lando Norris
the
extra point.
I personally don't think it'll come down to that. I think Verstappen will win a bit easier than that. But yeah, I mean, what do I know about Formula One? I hope Norris wins, but I can't see it, unfortunately.
All right, then, and with that, we'll round off the podcast. I thank Freddie Winter for taking time before announcing with me during the course of the Travers Grand Prix.
Can't wait
during this weekend. Anything you want to say in closing?
I mean, yeah, the thing I'll say is to anyone whose message I haven't got back to, you know, or whatever, I'm truly sorry. I had you know, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages, but I did read them, and I'm very grateful. So thank you for all the support to everyone. It's meant a lot, and it genuinely has made a difficult time into a more bearable time. So I'm very grateful.
All right, then, and this has been the latest edition of the TWBC podcast. Thank you very much indeed. If you want to reach out to me, podcast at waterskibroadcasting.com or Tony at tonylifer.com will get you to the same place. And I thank you once again for tuning in. I know it's been a while since I've gotten more recent episodes up, but between now and the end of the season, I'll try and get them up a little bit more regularly. There were some technical issues that I had to resolve before I had more relevant and more up to date content. But I sure appreciate you listening. So with that, this is Tony Lightfoot, and until next time, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.